Hi, I'm Dan Benjamin. I'm the founder of 5x5. And before we start today's show, I just wanted to take a minute to say thanks to all of you for helping make 5x5 what it is today, for helping me get the best job in the entire world. You guys have rated the show on iTunes. You've checked out our sponsors every week. And I just wanted to say thanks and thank you for listening. I'd like to say a great big thanks, though, to all of you who've donated your hard-earned money to help us out here with the big move from Central Florida to Austin, Texas, which is where we are now. If you'd like to help support 5x5, you can do that by going to 5x5.tv/donate. And thanks. This is Build and Analyze, a weekly news and discussion show about the world of the iPhone, iPad, iOS, and mobile web development. It's hosted by Marco Arment, who is the creator, the founder, and the inventor of Instapaper. I'm co-host Dan Benjamin. We want to say a quick thank you to our two sponsors, Omnigroup.com, and a new iOS app which integrates with Instapaper. It's called Worthwhile. And we'll tell you about those as the show goes on. Boy, do we have a lot to talk about, though. How are you, Marco? How are you?
Well, that's a great question. I've had
a
pretty crazy half hour, even.
Really?
So about 30 minutes ago, I was on the phone with a reporter talking about the FBI raid that happened to include one of my servers.
Right.
So there's that issue, which we'll get to in a moment. As I'm on the phone with that reporter, on our house phone, Apple called to ask. They saw a kind of suspicious computer order, and they wanted to know if I had placed this order that was using my credit card and being shipped to my house for a 15-inch MacBook Pro with a glossy screen.
Clearly not something you would ever
buy. That probably tipped them off. I'm sure everyone at Apple listens to this podcast and, right, and knows that I would never buy a glossy screen laptop again if I could help it. So they looked at that and they said, this couldn't possibly be the Marco that we know. But this is his credit card and it's being shipped to his house. So
It was on your regular phone, which you said many times, and we know they listen to the show, that nobody ever calls your home phone. That's just there,
right,
for, it's a, just there so you can have your high-speed internet connection.
Right. I don't even know when I gave Apple this number. I have no idea how they got it. Very few people have that number because I don't want people calling it, because it's just this phone sitting in my office that makes a lot of noise. So it turns out it was from some weirdo Gmail address. It was like the somebody had, using a Gmail address like MarcoArment5@gmail.com, placed an order for a 15-inch PowerBook using my credit card, but I think they screwed up and used my shipping address also. They probably hacked something. Got my credit card information from somebody who had it that included my billing address. So they typed in the billing address to use the card and then probably accidentally left that checkbox to say ship it to the billing address.
Oh, jeez.
So an Apple called me and they're like, this is a little bit weird. So they stopped it and I called American Express, had to cancel the credit card just in case. I changed my Apple ID password, which is the biggest pain in the butt password to change
possible. Man. Seriously.
Because granted, my Apple ID password was by far my least secure password because I hadn't changed it in a long time, and it was not one of those cool auto-generated passwords from 1Password because I have to type it in constantly. So I have to remember it, and it has to be fairly easy to type on an iPhone or iPad because every time you buy anything or update anything, you have to type it in. But I switched it now to one of those cool auto-generated passwords, and I guess I'll just learn to type it in eventually and do some kind of horribly insecure thing where I carry a Post-it or something with it for a while until I memorize it or something like that.
Yeah, so if you see Marco on the street holding his iPhone in one hand and a yellow Post-it note in the other, don't bother him.
Steal the Post-it note. And you can buy a computer and have it shipped to my house.
That's right.
It's just been a very bizarre half hour. And during that time, right in the middle of all this, my grill gets delivered. I ordered a grill because now I own a house, so that's required. And they come via one of those big shipping companies. Like in this case, it was Siva. So this guy has to come in. You have to sign the slip. The wheel's in this tremendous box. And they don't even come assembled, but the box weighs like 150 pounds because there's so much metal in there. So, oh, wow. So about that FBI server raid.
Yeah. Tell the story, because I'm sure there are some people who listen to this but don't maybe follow the news as much, and this is still kind of a fresh news story.
Oh, I have to go now. See, I have to go now and change everything that auto bills this credit card. Oh, man.
Would you rather do that than do the show?
No. Well, I don't have the new number yet. I won't have it till tomorrow. They're mailing it to me. American Express is really good, by the way. Like I just called them, 10 minutes ago, and they're overnighting me a new card tomorrow. It's going to arrive tomorrow, and of course, I'm not responsible for anything. I don't know if all the other credit card companies are that good about overnighting it to you and really making sure that you go as little time as possible without it. But their American Express is pretty great. So anyway, what happened with the FBI thing, which is I hope unrelated. Let's see. Yesterday, so Monday at about midnight on Monday, one of my servers is hosted at Digital One, which is a small host. They rent some space in a bigger data center that they don't own in Virginia. I forget the name of the company who owns the data center, but Digital One is just a small Swiss company that sold Blade servers, these cool little HP Blade servers, just inside of this this big data center, and so they sold them at very, very good prices. As far as I can tell, the company is two or three people. It's the tech guy who I've heard from, one sales guy. That's it that I can confirm. I've only ever seen emails from two people, so it's a very small company. But what I liked about them, and Pinboard.in was hosted there. Pinboard's it's a great service. It's a delicious replacement, but even better. And Pinboard was hosted there, and I was talking to the guy who runs that about it a while ago, and I figured they had such good prices, especially on the RAM. Their website's still down right now, but you could get a 12-core Westmere Xeon. I think the baseline was the 2.26 gigahertz one, which I think is the 5620. You can get two of those with 48 gigs of RAM and two basic hard drives in RAID 0 or RAID 1 for $500 a month, which is a really good price.
Yeah.
Anyway.
People might be surprised to hear that you actually host and manage physical servers as opposed to everything in the cloud. Maybe we can talk about that at some point.
That's definitely a good topic that maybe we'll get to today. It's been on my list forever, but this is a pretty good reason to talk about it.
Yeah.
So what happened was the FBI raided this host. Apparently they were targeting. No one knows much about this.
To be clear, though, it wasn't you they were raiding.
As far as I know.
Okay, and it wasn't. And as far as you know,
I think
it wasn't.
I would have heard by now, if they were.
And we don't think it was Pinboard either.
Right. Okay. And it probably wasn't me, because the rest of I have five servers. One of them was hosted there. The other four were hosted at SoftLayer. So I would imagine if they wanted to go after me, they would have gone after SoftLayer.
Right.
So I had one server there. It was a MySQL database slave. I was only using it to serve read queries, so it wasn't that important. It's important to performance in that without that, now all the queries have to go to the master server. So the master server is not very happy about this and is under high load and is slower than it should be. But I didn't lose any data. I didn't lose anything meaningful. It's just an inconvenience for me. But that's lucky, which I'll get to in a minute. Pinboard had, I think, three or four servers there, and I think one or two of them got taken. So what happened was the FBI went in looking for, a server used by some hacker for some of the recent stuff. People are saying it might have been the recent Lulzsec thing. I don't know. I think all that's speculation. I don't think anybody knows yet. One blog filed a request under the Freedom of Information Act to try to get a copy of the warrant, but that's going to take weeks, so... And the FBI hasn't commented, so officially we don't know anything except what the Digital One guy told, I think it was, is it Curd? Who's the big site that was hosted there? Anyway, some big site, I think it's Curb.
I thought you were the big site.
Well, I wasn't primarily hosted there. I just had one server there. Anyway, so this one site asked them basically... or they asked Digital One, hey, what's going on? And they got a response from their tech guy saying that that they worked with the FBI to have them physically locate the server they were looking for, but apparently the FBI screwed up, and instead of taking just that server, they've taken a few enclosures. And since these are Blade servers, I don't know the details of this. I've never used a Blade server physically, but I assume Blade servers are lined up vertically inside of a maybe like a 4U enclosure that probably looks like a traditional rack server, but a really thick one. Is that accurate? Do you know?
I think so. I mean, they're always changing the way that these things are. So it depends on like what generation of Blade server. But the fact is that they took, whether it was part of a rack or a whole rack, they took a whole bunch of servers and the networking gear that went with it.
Right, exactly. So rather than taking just the server they were looking for, they took like 40 servers or something. Like some kind of, the Digital One guy said, tens of customers.
Yeah.
I get the feeling they don't have that many customers. I get the feeling it's a very small operation. Somebody in the chat room just said it's probably 3 or 4 U. So yeah, these little Blade servers, the Digital One guy seemed to imply that the FBI didn't know what they were doing and took a whole enclosure full of them instead of one server. Who knows? I don't know what happened. That's literally the only information we have on this. Everything else is speculation at this point. But whatever the case, in addition to whatever they were looking for, which people are speculating was a hacker thing, they took a bunch of other people's stuff, including mine and pin boards, although not all of pin boards, and curbed and these other things. So
legally, is this just something that is acceptable and you can't do anything because this is the cost of, you know, justice in this country kind of thing? Or is this like, you can say, hey, this affected my business and I was like an innocent bystander here, so
well,
I get compensated? What's the deal?
I mean, the reality is I never expect to see that server again. Now, it wasn't mine. I was leasing it. They were, it's dedicated, so Digital One owns it. And I was simply paying them, $500 a month to use it. I don't expect that they're going to get it back. And from a few little things I've picked up in comments here and there, it sounds like when the FBI raids servers, it sounds like they usually don't return them. And if they do return them, they're trashed. Somebody said they're trashed. I don't know if that means just the data is trashed or they're physically trashed. I have no idea. Whatever the case, I don't expect to get the server back. And if Digital One, their whole website's down because the server that hosted their website was also taken. But if they ever get back online, I'm just going to cancel it. And I've already ordered a replacement from SoftLayer. I'm just going to keep it in-house for now.
So how would this have worked if you had been, let's just say, you had been using something that was completely a cloud service, or not, maybe not you, but whoever it was they were going after. Let's just say they were hosted on Amazon S3, for example, and EC2 or whatever.
EC2, yeah.
I mean, where technically in EC2, there isn't one single machine that they could, the FBI could go and get.
Right. I would imagine, I mean, I'm sure hackers and other illegal users, or I'm sure people have used EC2 illegally to do illegal things to try to avoid detection or at least avoid tracing of the owners. I'm sure that happens. It probably happens all the time. So Amazon probably has some deal with the feds, where like the feds give them a request, an official thing with or without a warrant. Who knows? Probably not doing all the stuff they legally have to do, because that's the way the feds work. Somehow, I'm sure the feds have some procedure where they can make Amazon give them, a snapshot of the machine they're looking for, or like a recent backup if they have something like that, or whatever. I'm sure Amazon has a way to give them whatever they have on.
Right. But does it need to be? I mean, in that sense, they just want the data. They don't care so much about the physical hardware, because they can't get, like you're saying, they can't get the physical hardware out of there. It's all everywhere. In this case, they could get both at the same time. And it's really
and it's a lot easier to just take both.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to grab a computer and walk out with it.
Right. And that's, the way they do things is they take as much as they can possibly take and then ask questions later. It's really a very, very brute force, imprecise effort to just take as much as they possibly can to shock and awe whoever it is, and to confuse people as to what was actually targeted. And then they figure it out later. And if you get your stuff back, I think you're lucky to get it back. And if you get it back, it's not in any kind of usable shape. And they just say, well, screw you. You shouldn't have been hosting criminal stuff. This is certainly this is my firsthand experience with this. But I've heard stories like that I expect very little of the FBI in this. Like, I expect them to do all the wrong things. So far, it seems like they have, and I wouldn't expect anything else. You know, the fact is, this is the U.S. police culture is a culture of shoot first and ask questions later. And certainly, once you get up to the federal levels, I think it gets even worse. And so I wouldn't expect anything good to come of this. That's why I already wrote the server off. Mentally, I'm like, I know I'm never gonna, that server's never gonna come back online. I know it's never gonna come back online. And I'm the data on it. It's a good thing I don't need the data on it because it's gone. And this is interesting. It's something to think about when you have multiple data center redundancy. That this is a pretty good case for it.
Yeah.
If they had gone in and stolen all of my soft layer servers, let's say I didn't have this digital one, well, because now I don't. So right now, all my servers are at soft layer, and they're all within a couple of cages. I think they're pretty close to each other physically. They're at least within the same data center. So the FBI could theoretically go in and steal all of my servers if they wanted to, based on anything. I mean, if somebody saved text about child porn to my servers, they could theoretically go in and raid the whole thing and take all my stuff.
Wow.
If they had some kind of warrant that's probably ridiculously easy to get. So, this kind of thing is a risk for any kind of web service that accepts any kind of user interaction at all. Like, there's always a risk of something legal happening that you couldn't really foresee or do anything about, and somebody somewhere misunderstands and fires off this, fires off the troops basically. And anyway, so if they come in and take all my stuff, it's a good thing that I have backups on S3 and on my local computer, because if all my backups were just in that data center, then the entire service would be gone. So I have code hosted on GitHub. I have, and everything's backed up like crazy locally from my computer. I have S3 backups of the database, and I even occasionally download the database to my local computer like once a month. It's huge, but I do. Right now, my database is about 230 gigs.
But how long does that download take, even over your FiOS, your fancy FiOS setup?
Yeah, FiOS is great. It takes about a day and a half compressed.
Wow.
If that happens, if you run a web service, you need to consider this possibility. Your code might be safe. Your code might be backed up in all sorts of places, but your data might not be. Databases tend to be pretty big, and once they cross a certain size, backing them up becomes a lot harder and a lot more expensive. Basically, once you can no longer run MySQL dump to back them up, it becomes a more complicated procedure. And by the way those work, for anyone who cares, the best way to back up a large database that's too large to run MySQL dump on without all the locks timing out is to have a slave that you can shut down and then just copy its MySQL data directory, and then turn it back on. If you can't shut one down, you can use one of the hot backup tools. There's InnoDB hot backup, and then there's a free one from Percona. I forget what it's called, but it's a free version of IB backup, and it's very, very good. You can use that to back up a server that's running without shutting it down, but it kills the I/O performance, and I wouldn't really recommend it.
I've got some for you to add to your list.
Yeah, sure.
At some point, I feel like we've brushed this topic, but at some point you've talked in depth about why you use PHP and that kind of thing. It might be neat to talk one day about why you chose MySQL over PostgreSQL or anything else.
Oh, definitely.
For that matter. Add that to the list, please.
Okay. Well, I don't want to type now because I don't like the sound of typing in podcasts.
Okay.
But that's okay. No offense to
the Merlin and John.
To I think all of your other hosts who type during their shows occasionally. Well, they have those super loud keyboards. I mean, at that point, I think it's just funny. But I have a boring keyboard that's not that loud, so I think it would be annoying.
I'll do my best to commit it to memory.
Yeah. So. Anyway, this is.
So you're recovering. You're recovering from this because of the fortune that you. Most of your stuff was somewhere else.
Correct, yeah. And so for me, I got off lucky here. For me, this was just an inconvenience. You know, it it has caused my main database server to be slow today and yesterday. And I got a new one installed by SoftLayer. I ordered it yesterday evening. They had it ready by last night. They're really good. SoftLayer, you know, the reason I went to Digital One for this other server is that they offered 48 gigs of RAM for an extra $70 a month above their base price, which is insane. And so for anything that's RAM limited, in this case I was using it as a database sleeve, which is great when you do a bunch of read queries. As much RAM as you can have is a good thing. And really for almost anything, a bunch of RAM is a good thing. So, you know, it was tempting to put it there, but I was skeptical of putting all of my stuff there. And ultimately the reason I hadn't moved everything there yet is because I knew they were a really small operation. And I knew that their support staff is pretty much one guy, as far as I can tell. Their sales staff is pretty much one guy. They have, as far as I know, no in-person employees at the data center. They just probably, you know, pay the data center's existing staff to go do whatever they need to do physically whenever that's needed. It's very, very bare bones. And they had recently had a few network outages to their stuff, which had annoyed me. So it wasn't really very good. I was thinking about putting a search server there if I deployed full site search, but you know, even that is fairly important, so I probably wouldn't even put that there. But I think now I'm done with them. But even before this happened, I was thinking, like, you know, this is a little bit iffy to put something really important there if I can help it. And SoftLayer is kind of the opposite. SoftLayer is huge. It used to be the Planet and SoftLayer, two different companies. Then SoftLayer bought the Planet, I think, last year or so. So SoftLayer is huge, and they have this ridiculously complex system to do everything. Their new ticket screen is insanely complicated, and it's their whole control panel, honestly, is a horrible interface, although it's better than the Planet's. I have yet to find any host, any dedicated or VPS or any kind of host that has a good control panel interface except Linode. If Linode did dedicated servers, I would probably host everything there because their interface is so good.
Yeah, they have pretty much everything. Gosh, they should sponsor the show.
They really should.
Shame on them.
So should SoftLayer. I'm giving them all these, well, except for I hope they don't mind that I just insulted their control panel.
Well, shame on Linode for not sponsoring.
Is that how it's pronounced?
Linode? I thought it was Linode like Linux.
Right, but instead it's Linus.
Right, but he says his name Linus because he's from that other country.
No. It's his name is Linus, but the OS is Linux.
Well, I don't know how to say it. You're asking
might
the wrong
be,
guy.
I can't. Be Linus. I don't know.
I can't pronounce anything. But you know what I can? You know what I can pronounce?
I heard you do something the other day. It was hilarious.
The Omni Group. These guys are the makers of productivity applications exclusively for Mac OS X, iPhone, iPad. They're known for their awesome software. Gold standard customer support, like you actually deal with real people. You're familiar with that. And palpable geekery. One of my favorite Omni Group apps is OmniFocus. I've been talking about this all week because I love this app. They said, Dan, what do you want to talk about? I said, OmniFocus. So this is designed to quickly capture your thoughts and allow you to store, manage, and process them into to-do items, which we all have to have lists, and this will work with the getting things done system or really any system that you feel like using or inventing on your own. It's very flexible. You can control things based on work mode, like, oh, these are my phone calls, these are my emails, these are errands, or you can use projects to help define actions that are related, which is a really, really awesome. It's one of my favorite features. And of course, they're syncing here. You can use your local network. You can use the cloud. I'm sure they're going to have iCloud support, but right now it works with Mobile Me until that goes away. You can also use any standard web dev server. So if you have a work group that you want to share with, you can do that and control your own data and not have to worry that the FBI is going to come and take it away. OmniFocus is available today for Mac, iPhone, iPad. You can check it out at omnigroup.com, or you can go to iTunes or the Mac App Store and search for OmniFocus because you can get it on your iPhone and iPad. Go check it out. Thanks to those guys. Great guys.
I have a great bit of follow-up. It turns out that I have something more to follow up on with Hypercritical again.
Oh,
which is awesome.
This is great. I love this.
So will John Siracusa. So he mentioned in your last episode of Hypercritical, I don't know what number, we'll link to it in the show notes.
22, I think.
Yeah, he mentioned how he had emailed Steve Jobs to ask for lossless audio formats
right,
being available for purchase. And then a few months later, Apple added the ALAT codec, the lossless, the Apple lossless audio codec.
And he's sort of, the subtext is that he's taking credit for this.
Right, exactly, which is pretty cool. That's entirely possible. Who knows? I love that he gave Steve Jobs the Google search results link. That is amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, I was... literally laughing while walking my dog past some stranger's house wearing headphones. I was like bent over laughing. I don't usually I can contain myself and just laugh in my head. That I could not contain myself. That was amazing. So anyway, he had said something like he was kind of surprised that they would just invent their own lossless audio format. And it turns out, I know a bit about this because I had an undergraduate thesis at my college, and I did mine on lossless audio compression because it's actually really easy. And I keep in mind, this was not only was this a long time ago because this was in 2004, also I'm not a very good computer scientist in the sense that I'm not good at the math or the theory. I'm only good at the application and the practice. This is an interesting story, I think. So let me know if it gets horrible. That's your job as the host.
Okay.
So I had an idea for an audio compression codec. And the idea was, you know, you can look... So generally speaking, the way lossless audio compression works is you have some kind of predictor function so that you try, you know, given a certain sample of audio, like the audio looks like a big wave, you know, it looks like a big waveform. And given a certain sample, you try to predict what's next in such a way that you get close enough and then you store the difference between the actual result, the actual sample, and what you predicted. And the idea is so that if you can store, instead of storing a bunch of 16-bit integers, if you can reduce that and store smaller integers, that, you know, only the offsets between what you predicted and what the actual wave is, then you can use some kind of variable bit length encoding and actually take up less space by storing small integers. So the whole idea of lossless audio compression is to try to predict the wave as best as possible to make the delta integers, you know, the difference between real and actual or predicted and actual, to make those as small as possible. So your predictor has to be pretty good. And there's this other problem of, you know, the nature of, you know, binary encoding is that if you want to chop off one bit off of a number, you have to be twice as accurate, effectively, because when you chop off a bit, you can only store half as many values.
Mm.
So you have to, like, you very quickly hit a wall of, you know, how much you can store or how accurate you can get. Like, if you're off by a few thousand in the 16-bit value, you know, you might be able to get it down to, like, you know, I don't know what, off the top of my head, I don't know, it might be like 9 bits or 10 bits, something like that. But like, if you can make your predictor accurate enough to hit it within a few hundred, then, you know, you can get down to like 7 bits, 6 bits, you know, but it's really, really hard to get much past that. And any kind of variable bit length encoding has overhead too, because you can't just store the bits straight because then you can't tell where each number begins and ends. So there has to be some kind of weird encoding that you do to say, all right, here's where this number begins. It takes up this many bits, and here they are. So there's overhead involved. So audio as it's stored is 16-bit. And what I found is that it's pretty much impossible, practically speaking, for general purpose input, like for most audio input, to really get much better than 50% compression. So you can get that down to about 8 bits per sample compressed on average. But you really can't do that much better than that just because of all those factors of, you know, you just can't make it accurate enough. And had I been a better computer scientist or information theorist, I'm sure there's some existing theorem or proof that this is probably about as good as information compression ever gets with this kind of input, but I wasn't capable of proving that, and I certainly didn't care to. But anyway... And I actually did my project was really about that and about my failed attempt to make my own audio compressor. My idea was, since these things look like waves, try to fit a polynomial curve to it using one of those best fit algorithms. And then, you know, so take a section of the wave, fit a curve to it, and then just store the coefficients of that equation that fits, that's the curve. And it turned out this was a terrible idea. And I actually did it. I implemented it. I had a compressor, a decompressor. It was insanely slow because there's a lot of things you basically have to do brute force on to try to figure out, okay, how long of a slice of audio do you take to encode, and then how many coefficients do you try to apply to that? And the least fit thing was not that fast. I was using some other library to do it, but it wasn't that fast. And so it was pretty rough. And then it was so inaccurate that it actually made a lot of the files bigger after compression. So it was a complete failed attempt. But what the most interesting part was that I discovered during all of this is that by far the most efficient naive implementation, like the most efficient relatively simple predictor, was really just like a very linear predictor. So one predictor is you just assume that the samples are all the same. So you assume if sample 1 is 10, you predict sample 2 will be 10, and then just store the difference with whatever it actually ends up being. Because sound is a wave and it doesn't jump around randomly in the spectrum, you're always going to be somewhat close to the last sample. So that's one. And the other one to do is you basically take the last two samples, form a line, a straight line between them, and basically extrapolate the next point of that line and assume that that's the next sample. Turns out that is more accurate than anything else I could come up with. And that achieved about 50% on average. And not only that, but that also came very, very close to FLAC and Shorten, which were the two like high-end lossless audio compression formats at the time. And I think they still are because no one cares about that enough to make new ones every year. So like the FLAC audio codec, you can come very, very close to what it does with that simple predictor of take a line between the last two samples and extrapolate one point from it. And then you predict it's that, you store the difference with whatever the actual sample is, and that's it. It's ridiculously fast to encode and decode, and you're basically limited by the hard drive at that point. And so for Apple to make their own lossless audio format is really very, very simple. You can code that up in an hour.
So what it sounds like you're doing is you're almost substantiating John Syracuse's already overly inflated ego in that, yes, in fact, it's likely he did trigger Apple to create this.
It's very possible. And
this is the worst news I've heard all day.
I know. My bigger point is that he sounded like he was under the impression that creating a lossless audio format is actually a lot of work, just like creating a lossy one. Like, creating the next MP3 format is a bunch of work.
Right.
And it's not easy. But it turns out lossless audio is really easy to do. And, it's very, very difficult to get beyond about 50% compression for most types of music. But if you're willing to just get that and to just deal with that, and if that's good enough, and think about it. If somebody's doing lossless audio compression, if somebody actually wants to store lossless files, it's like 30 megs a song. Like, those people probably don't care that much about their hard drive space usage, right? Like, is that a safe assumption?
I think those people are in it for a whole different reason than the rest of us.
Correct.
They don't care about space. They're doing something totally different than regular people.
Correct. So it turns out, like, that's one of the reasons why these formats are relatively stagnant, is that it just doesn't really matter. Like, either they can't get any better, or also that there's no demand to make them better, really. Because you can't, it'd be great if you could store lossless audio in a tenth of the space, like MP3, but that's not the case. That's not possible, as far as anybody knows. So anyway, that's that topic. MySQL on servers. Is there any more news before I talk about that? I don't know. I've been so overwhelmed by the FBI stuff and all this other great stuff going on. Any other news that I'm missing?
There's other little tidbits of news here and there. I don't think any of them are as impactful as this. There's a rumor that Amazon's coming out with a Kindle Touch type device. Is that a big deal to you?
Is there new information on that? Like from
not from
less
like reputable.
A few weeks ago?
There's some new stuff. It's not, I mean, it's nothing definitive. It's not a big, you know, not a big announcement. People putting, you know, different rumors together.
No, I don't know. You know, I have the...
What do you think about that? Do you think they have to do that? Do you think they have to come out with... Let's forget the rumors and let me just get your take on that. What do you think? Sure. Do you think to be competitive that Amazon has to come out with some kind of touchpad of some kind?
Well, so there's a difference here. Are we talking about a touchscreen e-ink reader like the new Nook Simple Touch, or are we talking about a tablet more like the Nook Color and, you know, and the iPad, really? Those are two very different products. I think... the Touch e-ink reader, you know, so Barnes & Noble just came out with the Nook Simple Touch, and I did a big review on my site. It's good in a lot of ways, but the problem with it is that it doesn't have the Amazon ecosystem behind it. And so it's, you know, it's a classic problem. It's like being a really big fan of Windows Phone 7. You know, like you can look at it and you can say this is pretty good, but the fact is, if you're looking to buy a new phone, you might not want that. If you also want if you want the iTunes ecosystem, the App Store, any, you know, the software available for it, the widespread accessory support, and all the other things that come with having a good ecosystem, so you can have a product that's good in an isolated way, but then. It's so dependent on the ecosystem that it ends up that even though it's good, you probably shouldn't buy one, and most people won't buy one. That's the situation the Nook Simple Touch is in. Definitely the situation Windows Phone 7 is in, and probably most webOS devices as well, at least so far. So you know, but you can look at both Windows Phone 7 and webOS, and most people who try them end up liking them. You know, like they're at least people in the press. They look like they're pretty good, you know, but again, it doesn't always matter. Like, that isn't enough. So the Nook comes out, has the exact same problem. Amazon, you could kind of say they don't really need to do anything about this, because the current Kindle 3 with its big plastic keyboard on the bottom, it's selling really well. They're selling tons of them. So you can kind of look at that and say they don't really need to do a touchscreen device to replace the e-ink Kindle. Tablets are different. I'll get to that in a second. But by using the Nook Simple Touch, anyone who uses it really, really wishes Amazon would make a touchscreen e-ink Kindle, because the keyboard on the Kindle is so terrible and it's so big. The buttons are terrible. Like the pagination buttons on it are terrible. The little five-way controller is a joke. I mean, it's horrible. It feels terrible. You got to like push it with your nail because it's so small. I mean, it's awful. Amazon is not good at designing buttons. I can guarantee you that. The Kindle 2 was better, and it wasn't even that good, but it was better in that regard. But the Kindle 3 was a huge step backwards in the button feel. So if they can get rid of the buttons and make the device physically smaller because it doesn't need that big keyboard, the e-ink screen, as we're seeing with the Nook, is fast enough to be responsive to touch and to show like little confirmation animations, like when a button is pressed, you make it look, right. You know, you invert the colors, make it look depressed, whatever. The e-ink screen is fast enough to do that now. And the new Nook is using the exact same screen as the Kindle from last summer, the Kindle 3. It's so like Amazon could have done this with this hardware. I don't know about the touchscreen. I don't know if that was available, but because it's an infrared touchscreen where it actually like shines infrared light across the front of it with this little band that goes inside the bezel or the bezel. And was it you that said bezel or was it Syracuse?
That was Syracuse. It's okay. Bezel.
I know. That was great.
I love that he said that though.
I know. I
just wait for that's like so, I just wait for those kind of moments on that show. I love it.
Well, we as internet people, you know, we live in the internet, and we usually read words a lot more often than we see them, or a lot more often than we hear them. And we can read and write them without ever having spoken or heard them. So there's so many words that internet people like us mispronounce because we've just never heard them spoken, even though we've used them constantly. Yeah. And I think that's obviously one of them.
That's
I have the same problem.
A side effect of the current generation of people who are spend far more time typing and reading, especially online, than speaking. The old day, everything was delivered, you know, through voice. That was the you know, the Roman times, the great orators, they would speak, and that was everything. And writing was like to follow that up, and now it's totally the other way around.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'd love it when John, who is such a smart guy, as much as I hate to say that.
He really is.
And then to hear him makes a mistake, I don't point it out. I leave it for the chat room or someone else to point out. I don't want to be the bad guy in that way, but I'll certainly circle back around and see where that's going. Our second sponsor today is Worthwhile. This is a brand new universal iOS app. Its goal is to transform your Twitter timeline and lists into a focused collection of articles recommended to you by the people that you trust. It's Twitter, okay, but filtered to include just the Worthwhile articles. Worthwhile is a tightly integrated app with Instapaper, too. It includes some special treats for subscribers. It lets you trivially sort through your Twitter feed and send all the best stuff right to your read later list with just a single click. It's got support for Twitter's lists that finally makes them useful, so you can follow all the noisy, loud people who recommend all the best articles without clogging up your main timeline. This is a great app, and they're doing something special this week, just during this promo, just for 5x5 people. The app's normally $3.99, but from the beginning of the week all the way through Sunday, June 26th, 2011, it's only $1.99. Go check this thing out. You owe it to yourself, and you'll be supporting the show, letting the sponsors know that this stuff actually works. So we appreciate you go checking it out. Worthwhile.
So, Amazon doesn't really have to make a touchscreen device because they're already the market leader in e-ink readers as far as we know.
But don't you feel that they have to make one to be competitive with a company like Apple, or to be competitive with where Android's going, even if it is an Android device?
Well, hold on. Well, so you're talking about tablets. I'm still on e-ink.
Okay.
So I'll get to that in a sec.
All right.
So in e-ink, I'd say they don't need to do anything differently than what they're doing now. They're doing very, very well in the e-ink readers. But the fact is, it's so much better with a touchscreen. I really, really hope that they give an update with a touchscreen and no keyboard. It's worlds better. I can't even say how much better it is. But the fact is, even now, I own both. I bought the Nook for Instapaper testing and everything. I own both the Nook and the Kindle 3, and I still don't use the Nook because there's very little content on there that I want. I can't make Instapaper send to it because they don't have the email gateway service that Amazon does. They have no API. I've tried contacting the Barnes & Noble on so many occasions for so many reasons. I've never heard back from anybody there. Amazon is responsive. They have their email gateway. They even attempted to make the Kindle development kit, the KDK, although I think they've abandoned that in favor of future Android plans. That's speculation, of course, but that sounds like, or it seems like by looking at it, that's what they're doing. So even though the Nook is a great device, I still don't want to use it. I even tried like buying some magazines and newspapers on it and some books, and the selection is significantly smaller than the Kindle store. I didn't compare it to the iBook store, so I don't know how it compares to that, but the Kindle store for both periodicals and for books is a lot bigger than the Nook store from my casual searching. Even I actually looked through, especially in periodicals, that I can verify because you can view all of the periodicals available on the Nook because it's only a few pages long on the device, like the list of all of them.
Right.
And it's like, I think it's like 40 or 50 different things, which is not that much. Like that's all newspapers and magazines available on it. And there were a lot of big ones that weren't that I wanted. So it's, and that are available on the Kindle store. So that's a big problem. So, again, it doesn't really matter. So with tablets, this is a bit of a different story. I think a lot of the problems the tablets have, and I've blogged a lot about this recently, so I'm not going to rehash it too much. A lot of the problems that competing tablets have is that they don't have this ecosystem around them. One of the biggest things people want to do on tablets is read. Another one of the biggest things they want to do is watch video. And a lot of these Android tablets and the BlackBerry whatever and the WebOS upcoming whatever,
yeah.
A lot of them, in fact, most of them don't have any kind of content availability for them that's legal. So the geeks don't care because they're all pirating everything and sticking it on via Double Twist. But the fact is, the rest of us, or the rest of people, do care about that stuff. Most people, if they want to watch a movie on their iPad, they're just going to rent it from the iTunes store or something. They're going to at best they might rip a DVD on their computer, but even that's beyond most people. they're not going to go download it from some BitTorrent site that they can't keep track of because it changes every 3 months through some crazy tracker. Like, they're not going to go through all that stuff and get some weirdo Ogg media file that they have no idea how to use and stick it into VLC. That's not going to happen. You know, regular people don't do that. And it's so much easier to just get it legally. You get it through Netflix, maybe Hulu if you're a little bit crazy, or you get it from iTunes. So all those storefronts, they need to work on the device for people to buy them because they care about that stuff. The ebooks too. People buy Kindle books. They buy iBooks on iPads. People read a lot on these tablets. Just, you know, they watch video a lot. They read a lot. I see people using them. I see people on trains. Like, I see people in real life. That's what they're always doing. They're always reading something or watching video. On planes. I mean, just look around. Look around in real life situations like that when you have not just geeks around you, but regular people, you'll see what people do on their tablets or on their readers or their smartphones. A lot of video, a lot of reading, a lot of games. So for any tablet to succeed, it has to have those storefronts. Android so far is not doing very well on that.
Right.
We'll see. BlackBerry, I don't think, even made an effort. We'll see what happens with WebOS and with the future devices, future Android versions, et cetera. But it's not looking good so far for anybody else. Amazon, though, could do it because Amazon is one of the very, very few people one of the very few companies who has content deals in place that are fairly reasonable. They have an MP3 store with great selection, so that they're pretty well set on music. Their video stuff is decent. It's not great, but it's decent.
Could
I don't
get better.
Know how it compares. It could, yeah. I don't know how it compares to iTunes because iTunes video is also a little bit spotty, like with what they have and what they don't. As far as I know, iTunes and Amazon are in the same range of video quantity and quality. I would assume iTunes is doing a bit better because they usually get better deals, but we'll see. I could be wrong about that. But it doesn't really matter. Whatever the case, Amazon is at least in the ballpark. So Amazon could very well make a tablet that integrates with all of their content storefronts. Now they have their own app store with no space in it. You know, I'm pretty sure that's the reason they made the app stores, to give themselves, you know, a retail presence in apps. That then when they make their own device, they can have that. So I think if anyone is going to put out a tablet that competes decently with the iPad, it's probably Amazon. I don't think any other firm that we've seen so far can do it because of these content deals being so lacking with all the other players. So we'll see what happens. And Amazon certainly has the ebook market.
It sounds like you're kind of saying that the way that somebody could compete with Apple isn't the way that these other Android competitors and even WebOS competitors are doing it, by saying, hey, we've got a great operating system, we've got these great features. You're saying that it's all about the content. Forget features, forget hardware, whatever. Just make a decent tablet. Just make it decent and put tons of great content on there, which you're saying Amazon can do.
Absolutely. I mean, the other manufacturers, HP is doing a pretty good job. You know, they bought Palm seemingly mostly for the software and possibly IP. HP seems like, as many people have intelligently said, they seem like they're trying to copy the Apple model of you own the hardware and the software and you integrate them nicely, and that's your product. We'll see if they actually do it and how well they do it, but it seems like that's what they're going for. BlackBerry is such a disaster. I think we can safely write them off at this point, just with all their internal and financial problems. The Playbook was obviously not a finished product. We don't have to care about them. If you look at the Android market, it's mostly these big companies like Samsung and HTC and Motorola who have, these are hardware manufacturers. They're almost generic at this point. Like, it's like you find some kind of electronic thing and you copy it and you put your name on it and you sell it for a little bit less than your competitors if you can, and you get a bunch of people in Best Buy and Sam's Club to buy it. And, you know, you do everything overseas and ship it over, and that's that. You know, Samsung is pretty good at selling TVs because that's how the TV market works. There's not that much software involved. At least users certainly don't see any of it. It's a hardware product, and it's very commoditized and very much purchased based on checklist comparisons. So the big generic manufacturers do very well at that. Feature phones, which I think is a terrible term, so I'm going to call them dumb phones. Dumb phones were not that different.
Yeah, feature phones is like the polite version.
I know. It means they have no features. It's a terrible. I mean, that's like the Patriot Act. I mean, it's a horrible name. So, you know, dumb phones are very similar. So all these companies did very well in the dumb phone market because, again, the software, there wasn't that much to it. Most of it was already provided by the carrier or by, you know, some other embedded OS thing. The differentiation was mostly in the hardware. It's like, how thick is the plastic lid on your flip phone versus how thick is the plastic lid on mine? And do you have an OLED screen on the back of it? Is yours blue or gray? Like, there's all these different hardware differentiators. And with those devices, the software was so simple and there were so few user-facing features that those companies could all do well because all the differentiation was what they do best, the weirdo hardware stuff. The tablet world is totally different. The smartphone world is kind of halfway between them, I think. But the tablet world is really on the other end. Very few people care about differences in tablet hardware, which is one of the reasons there aren't many. The fact is, if you're trying to make a 10-inch tablet, say, size of the iPad and the Samsung Galaxy Tab 10.1, but not the 9-point-something and not the 8-point-something, not the 7-point-something, who knows. If you're making a tablet, you're going to pretty much rip off the iPad as much as you possibly can, and that's going to be as good as you can get. That's certainly the model HP has taken. HP has basically said they have shamelessly ripped off every possible thing about the iPad hardware that they care to rip off. Everything. Samsung certainly has ripped off as much as they can from the iPad as well. HP at least is trying to do some better software differentiation, but they've shamelessly ripped off the hardware. It's very, very clear that, even the Samsung 10.1, the Galaxy Tab 10.1, it's almost exactly the same dimensions and weight as the iPad. Like it's so close that it doesn't really matter. They're effectively equivalent.
So,
basically, in tablets, there's almost no differentiation to be had in hardware. It's all about the software experience and the surrounding ecosystem. And Apple's doing so well with the iPad, and the reason why people want iPads, they don't just want generic tablets, is because Apple does that ridiculously well. They are really good at software and the ecosystem and the experience. A lot of people aren't buying an iPad because of its weight or its dimensions. They're buying it because of the experience. Nobody cares if it doesn't have a USB port. That's not a feature most iPad users care about. An SD card slot. Like, it's not a common problem that people have. And, like, very few people are choosing not to buy an iPad because of its lack of a port or its CPU speed. So Samsung and HTC and Motorola and all these players, they really don't know how to compete in that arena because they're all about the hardware differentiation. And they're in a market now where people don't care about that, as far as we know. So they take Android, which is really lucky for them that somebody's making an OS that's somewhat reasonable, and they bolt their crap on top of it, but it's really, really half-assed. Their interfaces, their custom applications, like, you really don't want to be using software made by Samsung if you can help it. And the market's responding by not buying these things. They're not doing well. I don't really see a scenario in which this works out well for those kind of players. I just don't foresee it because Samsung is not going around making deals to get content into their, well, they're trying, I think, but they're certainly not doing well at building an ecosystem around it in a way that matters. They're stuck in the kind of generic retail channels. They have they're totally at Google's behest with the software and the compatibility withholding and all that stuff that Google pulls. I just don't see this happening for them. Google could try to build their own. It would be a little bit better. They would be able to negotiate better deals with content providers, certainly. But I think Google's heart is not in hardware, and you could tell by how well they supported the Nexus One. there's a lot of problems with that too. So I don't see the Android tablets doing very well ever, unless something major changes in the ecosystem. Amazon, though, as we said, they have that ecosystem already. They have the content deals, they have the retail distribution, they have all that locked up already. all they have to do is produce some hardware. And the question of what would make somebody buy that instead of an iPad is a lot easier to answer if you think of Amazon making a tablet. So all the content stuff is probably taken care of. Amazon would probably price it aggressively. And so if you look at the new Kindle with special offers, which is it's an e-ink Kindle that's $25 cheaper because it displays ads on its sleep screen and on the home screen. My theory is that that's a prototype for a bigger ad subsidy on potentially a future tablet. Because, you know, Amazon says it's now their number one selling Kindle. It's, you know, yeah, sure, it's cheaper. But are that many people swayed by paying $114 instead of $139? Are that many more people buying it now that it's $25 less for a device that, like, the books on it cost $10 each?
Yeah.
Like, you can buy two books with that difference. I mean, it's like, I just don't think that that's really driving a lot of additional sales that wouldn't have otherwise happened.
Wayhan in the chat room says Amazon sees Apple as a threat if left unchecked, and that's a good enough reason to make a tab.
Right. You know, one possible reason that they entered that they made their app store, it might not have to do with a tablet. It might just be that Amazon as a retailer sells a lot of software. And so if the retail world is shifting to a situation in which software is not sold through resellers like Amazon, they want to wedge themselves in there and make sure that they are wherever the market is moving to. So if the market is moving to these curated app stores on these special platforms, Amazon wants to be damn sure that they are one of those app stores because they're a retailer. That's their business. They can't just sit around and be blockbustered. So, and they're very good at seeing when these things happen and jumping in there. So even if they weren't planning their own hardware, that would be reason enough for them to have their own app store. They can't have one on Apple's platform because Apple won't let them. But they can have one on Android because that's possible. So they're going to do their best to get in there and make sure they keep their retail presence. Unfortunately, nobody buys apps on Android. That's a different story. Oh, we're going to get so much email. But assuming they probably are making their own hardware because they're totally set up to do it. If Amazon uses their ad subsidy pricing and they produce some kind of basic, you know, plastic tablet thing, they could probably get an iPad competitor. I'm guessing they wouldn't go to 10 inches because that's really expensive. But if they wanted to make a 7-inch like Amazon Media tablet, you know, call it the Kindle Color or something,
yeah,
or the Kindle Touch, like they could do all that, or the Kindle Tablet. Hell, just use that. They could clearly do that. Maybe for $400-$300 at a component cost, and then if they add subsidize it, they might be able to get that down to like $250, maybe even $200 eventually. I don't know when, but eventually. So if you picture a future, maybe a year from now, say, when Amazon has this Kindle tablet, say, runs Android, but it's fairly well masked in the sense that it's mostly Amazon stuff that you see. It's Amazon's media players and storefronts, their app store. Most of Android is kind of buried under the Amazon shell, similar to how the other Android manufacturers have their own weirdo shells on top of it. Picture that as a tablet, launched by Amazon. It's on the Amazon homepage every single day for 2 years, the same way they sold a bunch of Kindles by putting it on their homepage of this massive retailer. They push the crap out of it, and it's like $250. That's powerful.
Yeah.
And that is a really, really interesting iPad competitor. I don't think anything else we've seen in iPad competition so far has a chance. The HP TouchPad is interesting in that they've ripped off the iPad hardware seemingly pretty well. The software, they actually seem like they're doing good things there. I haven't used it, but I'd love to. Hey, HP, send me one for free. But it looks like their software is going to be pretty good. The problem, though, is that it's similar to the Windows Phone 7 problem that we see now and the webOS on phones problem that we see now. You can't just be just about as good as the iPad. Like, if you release an iPad competitor, like the touchpad that looks the same, is the same price, and the software is pretty much as good. You know, most people look at it and say it's pretty much as good. Has no apps, but you know, even if that problem gets fixed, like the market leader is so powerful, that's probably not enough reason for people to buy the touchpad. It needs to be different in a bigger way to get over that hump. You know, to get over the hump of why should I buy this besides an iPad? You know, why not just get an iPad for the exact same money that's exactly the same looking but has all these other benefits? Amazon could actually come over that hump pretty well by doing this, you know, a tablet that would be possibly dramatically differently priced, possibly a different size. You know, those are big differences. But trying to make an iPad that looks just like the iPad that isn't one, I think is not a good strategy. And that's the strategy that HP is taking so far, and I don't like – I just don't see it ending well for them. I see it being very similar to webOS on phones, which, again, it's like people like it. They say it's pretty good, but it never really gets a lot of market share or traction. What do you think?
I mean, I think you've
nailed your question.
Yeah, oh, more than an answer. I mean, I think you really nailed the critical part of the issue. So my question then back to you would be, why don't these companies, whether it's HP or whoever else, I mean, Amazon having not released a tablet device of any kind, we can only speculate. But it seems like Amazon's focus has always been content. If you look at the Kindle, it's about content, getting content on there, delivering that, making it easy to deliver it. Clearly, Amazon knows how to sell stuff. They know how to run stores. You touch on all these points. Why don't the other companies get that? Why aren't they trying to focus on this? I mean, is it done for them? It kind of sounds like you're painting a pretty grim picture for them.
Well, BlackBerry's doing a pretty good job of killing themselves, so I don't even need to address that. you know, in the Android tablet, again, it's like these manufacturers who, like Samsung knows how to make VCRs really well, right? Like they knew how to sell VCRs. You know, it's a hardware thing. You do what everyone else is doing. I mean, obviously you can tell within that company, they have a deeply ingrained culture of copying. You can tell by looking at all the stuff they rip off of Apple. Samsung is really, really good at being a knockoff company, effectively. And not to say not in terms of quality, but in terms of product inspiration and you know ideas and designs, they obviously are a knockoff company. And in their culture, in their company culture, that's obviously okay. That's considered a normal way of doing business. So in everything else they sell, like you know other electronics and things like that, they're a huge company. They have lots of other products, but you know. Focus on consumer electronics here. Other things they sell, there's not that much area for differentiation. So, like, if you make a TV that looks a lot like a Panasonic TV and you call it a Samsung TV, it's no one's really going to complain. It looks pretty much the same anyway. Like, and so they're applying their method of doing that to this new world that's so much based on software and environments and ecosystems that I don't think they would ever prioritize. Getting these content deals, I think they would expect that it would be as easy as it's always been for them to get software, which is there's some kind of off-the-shelf thing that they install on their devices and they just focus on the devices, maybe with a very, very thin layer of their own software on top. But for the most part, it's you know they're not doing much there. And so maybe they're just waiting on Google to do this. And I think that's the future of Android. Tablets and possibly even smartphones, I don't know. I think Google sees this as a problem, and they're going to be the ones who are going to try to go around and get the deals and make their own content storefronts. But so far, they've been really bad at it. And I don't know why. That could also be a cultural thing with Google or just an issue of priorities. For whatever reason, Google has been very, very bad at this so far. They have their music thing that's barely functional and has like no deals. I mean, they're doing this very poorly so far, the whole ecosystem thing with media. They're doing fine on the internet services thing. They have a great email service a lot of people like, but not doing so well on the content storefronts. So I imagine Samsung is just, you know, and HTC and Motorola, they're all just waiting for Google. But if Google actually gets these things the way they want, let's predict the future in a year from now where Amazon is doing well against the iPad, And Google comes out and says, all right, now we have a video store, a music store, and an ebook store that's just as good as these other ones. Has just as much stuff, all the first name stuff, not just a bunch of free stuff that we dug up. Let's say they actually come out with this. That could be a big problem for HTC, Samsung, and Motorola, because now they're ridiculously commoditized. And Google has all the power in that relationship. Then, effectively, it's just like the PC world was with Microsoft and Windows, where the OEMs have to do this horrible business where they're just competing for pennies and undercutting each other constantly, and they're totally commoditized. And all their stuff is pretty much the same, undifferentiated stuff, because it's Google doing everything on the software side. I don't know how well that would work for us as consumers. Like, that would certainly be better than the current tablet state from Android. As manufacturers, I certainly would not want to be in that situation. And I would imagine there's been some pretty uncomfortable meetings with the manufacturers and Google over, as we saw with some of the paperwork from the Skyhook lawsuit. You could see, like, Google is not being very nice and accommodating with their Android compatibility licensing and all that stuff. And you know, you look at Honeycomb, and nobody has the source code yet, and Google says don't use it unless we let you use it. This whole thing about open, I think, is closing. As Google realizes that they're actually much better off if they keep it fairly closed. I mean, open was always kind of BS, but I think they're making it much more BS over time. So that's the future I see is, you know, about a year from now, we'll see what these people are doing. It might be a lot of nothing. You know, it might be very similar to this year in that Apple's still doing their thing. They're still kicking butt with the iPad, and everyone else is kind of making these half-assed attempts that never go anywhere. You know, keep in mind, only a few months ago, everybody thought the playbook was going to be a really big deal.
Yeah, it's a great point.
And then right before it's released and everyone started playing with the review units, they realized, well, this is going nowhere. Keep in mind also, 2 years ago, everyone thought that the Palm Pre was going to kick the iPhone's butt. It was going to be an iPhone killer. They used that, the killer word, the K word in tech press, because everything always kills everything else, right?
Right.
And they thought that the Palm Pre was going to be the iPhone killer, and it came out and nothing happened because it wasn't actually that great. It was, you know, decent, not great. Windows Phone 7, again, everyone gets those units and they love them. Oh my God, this is great. This is going to be the iPhone killer, and Microsoft's going to do the thing they always do. Well, nope, they didn't. It wasn't, and it didn't work. And so far, I would say if you look at the smartphone market right now, I don't think anybody would say that Apple has that much to worry about from either webOS or Windows Phone 7, and certainly not BlackBerry, because they're imploding. So look at the tablet market. So everyone thought, again, Playbook was going to be great. Comes out, nothing happens. Then you look at the touchpad is coming out next week, right? We'll see what happens there. My guess is that it's going to come out and it's going to get the same reviews that webOS hardware always gets, which is, this is pretty good, and there's some pretty good stuff in the software. And then it's not going to get popular. No one's going to buy them, and it's going to be marginalized, just like webOS on phones. Because all of the issues that made webOS on phones not do well are still there, and you know all the tablet issues that we've been talking about, those are all applying here. So I don't see the iPad dominance changing at all for the foreseeable future. Amazon doing something would be a big deal. I don't know how effective it would be, but it would certainly have a better chance of succeeding than anything we've seen so far. But I think in a few months, we're going to look back on both the Playbook and the touchpad and kind of laugh at how everyone thought they were going to do so well. But we'll see. I'd love to be proven wrong on any of these things, because Apple does best under competition. And I mean, the fact is, my business is fine regardless of what happens, because people choose to read on tablets a lot. And so whatever tablet wins, I'll be there. I'll go to that one. So I'll be fine. Apple, I would prefer that they win, but I would also prefer that they have competition. And, you know, effective competition. You start looking at all the stuff that's happened to iOS since Android's gotten popular in the smartphone world. And Apple has made incredible strides in iOS since then, because they've had their butt kicked a bit, and they really are not sitting still. That's how they do best. In the tablet world, that hasn't happened yet. And you know, so the iPad is benefiting from iOS being improved in general, But still, it would be great to have a really strong tablet competitor to really kick Apple's butt a bit and keep things moving. So we'll see. You know, a level of healthy competition is very, very good for everybody. And the iPhone finally got it after years. They finally got healthy competition with Android. The tablet market hasn't seen that yet.
It's a good topic, man.
We've talked about this a lot, but I feel like it keeps coming up in the news, and it does keep seeing minor changes as things come out and flop. So I think it's worth talking about regularly because this is a big deal. You know, a lot of people always ask me, what language they should learn first or what they should start programming first. And the answer is I don't really know, but it's never bad to go where all the action is happening. And so I think you could say, like in 2005, all the action was happening in web apps only. Nothing was happening on the desktop. Nothing was happening in mobile.
Right.
2005, it was all about web apps, and specifically networked web, like network effect web apps. 2009, I'd say it's social everything and a lot of mobile stuff, and in particular, mobile apps that use web services as their backend for any kind of social or networked features. That's where all the hot stuff is happening. Now we have tablets as an addition to that. Desktop might be coming back a little bit with some of the cool Mac stuff, but probably not. Desktop's probably pretty stable. All the action right now is in mobile and tablets and the associated web services that back them. So that's where you want to be. And, the enterprise software world is going nowhere. It's always going to be there, very stable. It's like the water company. There's always going to be people demanding water, but it's not the most exciting place to work. Wow, we get so much email from all the people who work at the water company. When we're on the cutting edge like this, this is a show theoretically about mobile software development and web software development. And regardless of what we actually end up talking about, that's where everything's happening. Everything right now is mobile and web. So that's where you want to be. And I don't think it's a bad thing to discuss it every week because it's very relevant.
I mean, I say we discuss it until it's not relevant every week.
There you go.
So what else you got?
I think that's it. I ordered a new AeroPress to replace my my current one. I've used it every day for about 11 months, sometimes often twice a day. And because it's made of plastic, the constant heat and pressure, I also press a lot harder than they tell you to. They tell you to like press gently. I push hard down on the plunger. So I've developed a couple of cracks in the plastic, and like when the plunger scoots past them, you hear them bubbling and leaking, and like nothing leaks out yet, but it's only a matter of time. So I ordered a new AeroPress to replace that one, and I still have never had to order filters because it comes with so many. People keep asking about whether I've tried the stainless steel filter disc that somebody made for the AeroPress. I haven't yet, but I ordered one with the new one, so I'll try that and see how that goes. And that's about it for that topic. So in the chat room, Absman suggested that I talk about cloud versus dedicated for Instapaper.
That's a whole show. We can't do that.
That's a whole
week.
Show.
Yeah.
We'll do that next week. And along with
great topic.
Well,
we definitely do it, but we're 75 minutes in.
Yeah, we're done for this week.
So where can people go if they want to keep up to date with the latest Instapaper news or news from the personal side of Instapaper? Marco.org is good for you.
Yeah, Marco.org for the blog, and then Marco Arment on Twitter.
Good thing. Good places to go. And I'm Dan Benjamin on Twitter.
Hi, Dan. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. How are you today?
Busy.
Well, good luck. Good luck getting this sorted out. You will be updating us at least, if not on the blog, then next week on the show with whatever the fallout is from this, right?
From the FBI server thing.
Yeah.
Honestly, I don't think there's going to be anything. Like, I think I'm never going to hear about the server again.
Just done.
I'm going to go cancel it. Once they get their website back up, if they get their website back up, I'm just going to cancel the server, and that's it. I mean, I've totally written it off as a loss mentally, and I've moved on, and I'm setting up a replacement server right now. As we speak, things are transferring to it. So, you know, it's one of those things, kind of like the patent issue, where, yeah, I could choose to make a big stink about it and to try to get some kind of justice or reimbursement or something. But the fact is, none of those things are worth the time that they take when I'm busy. And I would much rather be running my site and writing my software. And so that's what I'm doing. I'm just moving on in the most pragmatic, practical way possible. And whatever happens with this, it seems like it was intended to be none of my business, and it'll probably stay none of my business. And, you know, it's like the fire truck just drove over my lawn on the way to the real fire. You know, so, you know, I'll fix the damage and move on.
Well, good luck sorting it out and getting everything. Sounds like you're pretty much back to normal,
it's mostly done. I mean, again, it was only a slowdown. It wasn't even an outage that it caused. So it's really just an inconvenience. The pinboard guys were hit much worse.
Yeah.
And fortunately, they handled it very well. And as far as I know, they're probably close to full capacity.
It seems like they're back almost to normal.
Yeah, they handled it very, very well.
Well, thanks everybody for tuning in. And we'll be back next week. You can check 5by5.tv/schedule because we are changing times around as I sort of attempt to get settled here, and Marco being very flexible with the schedule, so thanks. And you can go to 5by5.tv and just check out all the other shows that we're doing here. And if you're wondering what Marco is talking about when he says hypercritical, that's another show. You should check that out too. Anything else to add, Marco? You're all good.
And that's it.
All right. Download Instapaper. Have a good week.
You too.